Hello, everybody, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. I'm Grant Podolko, an editor at rferl.org, and I'll be your host again this week. In this episode, we've got a fascinating interview with journalist, author, critic, and columnist Christopher Hitchens. Hitchens touched on topics ranging from his attraction to revolutionary politics, the situation in Afghanistan, Václav Havel's place in history, and the current confrontation between the West and Iran over Tehran's nuclear program.
I think they've asked for a fight and should know that on those conditions they certainly will get one.
But first, Russia, where opposition leaders have slammed the multinational BP for signing a major oil deal last week. The company has dismissed the condemnation as political, saying the company is involved only in business. But Kremlin critics counter that the agreement to develop huge Arctic oil reserves is political, saying the Kremlin is using BP to legitimize its forced takeover of the country's oil industry. Here's correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer.
What a difference a couple of years make. In 2008, gun-wielding police commandos raided BP's Moscow offices in what many believe was meant as pressure for the company to relinquish control of its Russian joint venture.
Russian prosecutors have summoned the British boss of TNK BP to answer allegations of labor law violations.
Russian television reported a mounting list of accusations against BP employees, including alleged tax fraud by the joint venture's American chief, Robert Dudley, who fled the country after police questioned him for 5 hours. But last week, Dudley was back in Moscow. Now CEO of BP, he sat smiling next to Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who praised the firm's major new deal with Russia's state-controlled Rosneft oil company.
This project may become very big and have significant influence on the global oil and gas industry.
The two companies will swap shares as part of the $8 billion deal to develop massive oil deposits under the Arctic Kara Sea. The news comes less than a month after former oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky was sentenced for a second time on charges his supporters say were politically motivated. Khodorkovsky's Yukos oil company was broken up in 2004, its best assets sold to BP's new partner Rosneft, making it the country's biggest oil company. That was part of the Kremlin's drive to put the energy industry back under state control, something opposition leader Boris Nemtsov says Putin now wants to help legitimize by giving some Rosneft shares to a major international company.
The deal is a very bad decision, showing the fundamental values of human rights and property rights are just words that are forgotten as soon as the issue is money.
BP has dismissed the criticism. The company's head of operations in Russia, Jeremy Huck, appeared on Russia's radio Echo Moskvy to say that criticism of the Yukos sale was political, whereas BP is in Russia to do business.
The projects we're planning with Rosneft are sanctioned by the Russian government. The question about where those assets are from, that's better asked of Rosneft or the government.
Many believe BP is willing to overlook its past treatment because there's so much money at stake. Conventional wisdom has long held that actions such as Khodorkovsky's arrest and the forced takeover of assets belonging to Yukos, BP, and many other companies scare off Western investors. In fact, Western companies have clamored to invest because once in, those with the knowledge and power to operate in Russia face much less competition than elsewhere. Political expert Stanislav Belkovsky says BP's deal is especially important for the company in the aftermath of its major oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico last summer.
BP agreed to the deal, essentially legalizing the Yukos takeover, not least because it needs the cash to help solve its internal problems.
Last week's agreement will secure future growth for BP after some questioned the company's very survival in the wake of the disastrous Gulf of Mexico spill. But for public relations, whether the deal does anything but further blacken BP's image is another matter. Gregory Pfeiffer, RFERL.
And now, our interview with Christopher Hitchens. I invited writer-at-large Jamie Kirchick into the studio to talk a bit about his recent visit with Hitchens at the author's home in Washington, D.C. Jamie, welcome to The Blender.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about how this interview came about?
Well, I've known Christopher for a couple of years, and I think that he's traveled a lot in our region, and he's very interested in many of the countries that we deal with and the history of the Soviet Union and communism and Islam, which are all topics that are very pertinent to what we do. So I'd been wanting to sit down with him to talk about these things for a while, and I know that he'd been giving a lot of interviews over the past 6 months or so because he'd been diagnosed with cancer, esophageal cancer. So he'd been talking a lot about that and talking a lot about atheism because he wrote a best-selling book about atheism called God Is Not Great a few years ago. And he'd given so many of these interviews talking about the same things that I figured he'd want to talk about something else. And he did, and I thought we had a very lively, entertaining conversation about topics that he's very knowledgeable about, but I feel a lot of people don't get to hear him opine on as much because he's just been in the news so much lately due to his illness, unfortunately.
All right. How would you categorize his viewpoints, his politics? He seems like a hard man to pin down.
He is. I would say there are several values, I guess, that he would say that he adheres to throughout his political career, which would be secularism, sort of libertarianism and individual rights and individual liberty,
right.
Maybe anti-imperialism. So maybe those three things I think he would define as being his touchstones. Famously, he's had a lot of political falling outs with his former comrades on the left over his support for the Iraq War. But he's still, very left-wing on a whole lot of issues. So he really is hard to pin down. He and I have heated disagreements about many things, but what I really appreciate about him is that he doesn't make it personal, and that's very rare these days. It's more of a British
sensibility.
Yeah, in England there's a real big gulf between people and political opinions there in Parliament, much more so, and among journalists. You have real communists in that country still, and you have real hard right people. And they kind of mix and mingle, and they get along socially, and they write for each other's magazines, and they go out for drinks, and they have dinner together in a way that doesn't really exist in Washington, which is really a tribal town. And I think Christopher's very unusual in that sense. And then he'll have a dinner party at his house with, Grover Norquist, who's a anti-tax crusader, and, some socialist from some country you've never heard of, and they're all mingling together at the same dinner party. So I think that's kind of what I appreciate about him.
Now, Christopher has been in the news lately as much for his illness as for his political writings and viewpoints. How's he doing?
I've seen him a couple times since he was diagnosed, and one time I saw him, he was not doing that well and had to leave the table early. Another time I saw him, he was much better. So I think it fluctuates back and forth. He's been very open and honest about it and says that the diagnosis isn't good and that his chance of living even for 5 years is not very high. But I know he's undergoing a lot of different experimental treatments, and he's really just, doing whatever the doctors tell him to do. So, who knows? Hopefully he'll be here for many more years. But
now, the first question that you asked him in the bit that we're about to hear was about how he got interested in revolutionary politics, right?
Yeah, yes. Which he grew up, I guess, at the right time, you'd say. He was 18 in 1968, which would have been just the right moment to be going out in the streets and throwing Molotov cocktails and running to the barricades. So it's kind of hard for me to look back on that period and say, would I be doing the same thing or whatnot? I think we're just so complacent today, people my age, youth just don't feel compelled to take the kind of radical actions that people in 1968 did. But I guess if you grew up in that time, that's what you did.
All right. Well, let's hear his answer to that question and many others. Take a listen.
What was it that attracted you to revolutionary politics?
What drew me to revolutionary politics was, I'd have to say, the sheer fact that they were revolutionary. That I could feel, I was born in 1949, so I was almost the perfect age to be at university in 1968. And to have become very outraged by a number of things, principally the Vietnam War, but not alone that. And to be very discontented, as many people were for different reasons, with the boring post-war, partly social democratic, partly conservative consensus. So, in a sense, the sheer promiscuity of the word revolution, I have to say, had some attraction to me. I think it's worth remembering that in 1968, at the height of what we thought of as, and I still do think of as, the appalling aggression accompanied by chemical destruction of its environment and people and other appalling things of Vietnam. In the United States, the Democrats were in power, in some ways quite liberal Democrats. In Great Britain, the Labour Party was in power. In what was then still Western Federal Germany, there was a grand coalition of social democrats. In other words, if you wanted to oppose from the left, you had to go quite a long way to the left, because a sort of official left was already there. I think that context might be important. But it was more than anything else that actually, with what I think of still as a sense of history that I can sometimes call on, I actually felt one was entering a revolutionary period. I'll say quickly. The rejection by black America, often violent rejection, of its long condition of servitude. Very dramatic. The takeover in the middle of Mediterranean democratic Europe, Greece, with all its metaphors of democracy and so forth, by a right-wing military dictatorship protected by NATO. The war in Indochina. The way in which white Rhodesia was allowed to get away with a rebellion against the crown by what seemed to us a spineless regime. The extraordinary stirrings in Latin America, which had for long been a kind of backyard of American empire. A number of other things. And then, as the year rolled by and mounted, a social rebellion nearly put an end to the de Gaulle's Fifth Republic, which was long overdue to be put to sleep anyway. And in Poland and in Czechoslovakia, the very, very interesting stirrings, very intelligible to those of us who thought we were Trotskyists, supported the left opposition tradition of intellectual and working class opposition to Stalinism. So, you know, one would hear speakers saying we might be living through another 1848 or even another 1917 or 18. And it didn't seem all that much of an exaggeration. So it took a long time. One had to live a while to realize that what I was actually seeing was the end of a long stretch of the European left.
When did you realize that the Soviet Union was irredeemable as a political force in the world?
Until I was born in 1949, and I grew up thinking of the Soviet Union as irredeemable. I mean, I had read Darkness at Noon, for example, Arthur Koestler's masterpiece novel about Stalin show trials, on my own, and I'd been given 1984 to read. I would have read anyway in my school curriculum. And when I was seven, it's one of the first times I remember watching the news. In 1956, the two great international events were the doomed British invasion of Egypt with France and Israel and the Hungarian Revolution and the repression by the Red Army of a popular revolt within a European capital city with tanks. You see it on the TV. So I was one of those fortunate people, I suppose, didn't have any illusions to lose in the Soviet Union. And you regarded it with plain horror as a ramshackle, corrupt, dangerous empire, but one that wouldn't last for very long. I never believed that it could survive its present. But that would be easy to do. I mean, in other words, any fool could do that who could read a book against Stalinism. But in experience as well as theory, I was in Cuba in 1968 in the run-up to the invasion of Czechoslovakia, as it then was. And I knew quite a number of the Czech student leaders and others who were trying to declare their own independence from the Warsaw Pact, from Russian domination, of Eastern Europe, because the Russian Empire is slightly different from the Soviet Union, but coextensive with it. And I thought the Russians were going to invade. I didn't see what choice they'd have. They couldn't let it go. But nor did I think could they invade without completely, as if you like, losing their credit. That would be the end of it. And I took part in various arguments that took place in Cuba, in Havana, during that week in August, including Fidel Castro's endorsement. And then you could still meet people, reasonable people who are still members of the Communist Party in Western Europe. I knew quite a lot of them. Their whole expression changed, you know, from then on. It was as if their mainspring had broken. It often took them a long time actually to leave. But I can't remember anyone joining after that, for example. I just remember thinking, I've seen the end of it. I don't know how long it's going to take. It took 20 years, but it's over. That was, if you like, more demonstration than one needed for the situation.
Since we're on that topic, do you think a nuclear Iran can be contained?
No. I don't think, actually, a theocratic Iran can be contained even without nuclear weapons. I think there's a confrontation in our future between our civilization, I'll say that without embarrassment, the world that at least respects, if it doesn't always practice, the rule of law, and that has devised certain forms of diplomacy and certain systems of arms control to which the Iranians are legally signatories, and a regime that has the clearly expressed ambition to break out of and to trample all those conventions. We already see it in the threats to their Arab Sunni neighbors in countries like Bahrain, in their export of violence, as far away as murdering Jewish community leaders in Argentina, or Kurdish exiles in Berlin and Vienna, for heaven's sake, or a novelist friend of mine living in London writing fiction. I think they've asked for a fight and should know that on those conditions they certainly will get one. I was at a Hezbollah rally, well, so yeah. Were you, in Beirut a little while ago, and I couldn't but notice that the party symbol of Iran's main client in that country, Hezbollah, is now a nuclear mushroom cloud. In cartoon form, the cartoon is made up of words which, when decoded, constitute a threat to the Jewish state, the Jewish people. Well, I wouldn't want to look back and think, I wonder if I should have paid attention to a threat like that. You may say one is alarmist. I could give you also all the reasons why that could be a bluff. They don't have it. They just want you to think they do. It's a way of aggrandizing themselves. I know that's all partly true, too. But behind it, there's a reality, and the reality would be the emergence of a thermonuclear theocracy. The one thing we've, since I was at school, been lying awake worrying about, what happens when apocalyptic weaponry is grabbed hold of, laid hold of, by messianic totalitarian forces? Well, we are about to find out. If we want to run that experiment, they're ready to do it for us.
So that's the worst. There are no consequences of
an attack. No consequences could possibly be worse than that, because I'm not one of those who thinks they would immediately use it on the Israelis, let alone on the United States. I think they want it for purposes of blackmail. Principally against other Muslims and non-Persians in the region, or at least initially. The mullahs have a great racket, bleeding their country dry and running it into the ground and sucking out the surplus. Most of them don't want to give it up. But it doesn't mean that a later regime wouldn't be much more extreme, and they'd have the same weapons. So we have to take that into account. But in the meanwhile, we'd have to live in a world where, perforce, we were polite and accommodating and agreeable to these characters, and I decline to live on those terms. I won't do it. The best speech made by Churchill on the most overused example, of course, of this kind of compromise, but still I think the best and one of the least known, as he finally said in one speech, is it's not that one objects particularly to any one policy, internal or external, of the Hitlerite regime. It's that you basically don't want to live on the same continent as them. You don't want to be breathing the same air. And in the long run, in fact, you aren't going to be able to. One of you is going to have to yield. There is, and I think should be, so I'm glad there is, a radical incompatibility between a civilized world order, which aspires at any rate to democracy and free exchange, and totalitarian, expansionist, fanatical regimes.
Did the overthrow of Saddam Hussein strengthen the Iranian regime, or is that question moot if they're simply next on the list?
If I was asked if the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein regime had the effect of strengthening the Iranian one, I think I'd have at least two or three replies. One would have to be yes, in the short term. It gives it access to an audience of co-religionists within Iraq. who are by no means its puppets, but yeah. over whose leadership it does exert influence, not all of it financial, but some of it. On the other hand, it gives them the knowledge that on their near-abroad frontier, as with their Afghan one, there are forces that are keeping an eye on them, namely ours. And we're as near to them as they are to us, if you see what I mean. Bear that in mind, too. I have some reason to think from talking to Iranian dissidents, both in Iran, where I've been, and in the diaspora, that when the Iranian people see free elections taking place in which Shia voters, they're not all as sectarian as that, but let's just keep it to that, and Shia parties compete against one another, they're not completely unimpressed. They don't want anyone to think, of course, that they would take an Arab country as a model. No person would ever allow that. But the free press, the satellite dishes and cell phones and the rest of it, these are unquantifiable. Well, that's harder to judge than the immediate influence exerted by Ahmadinejad on some Iraqi client. But they deserve to be mentioned too, and I think could equally be, not more equally be, could be more in influential in the long run. Second, do we wish to go back to a time when Jimmy Carter was encouraging Saddam Hussein to rearm in order that he could invade Iran, apparently to do the United States a favor, in a war that failed to bring down the Khomeini regime, did strengthen the Saddam Hussein regime, did strengthen dictatorial tendencies in Iran, and not incidentally took the lives of perhaps 1.5 million people, and beggared the off. No, I mean, this playing off of Iran against Iraq is one of the foulest parts of our recent mm-hmm. statecraft. What one wants is to end it by putting both countries in the control of their own people. And that might sound simplistic, but it could not possibly be worse than the competing dictatorship calculus which we operated on before.
So there's no point at which the consequences of the Iraq war would outweigh the benefits?
No, certainly not. Because apart from anything else, it's invariably a good thing to see Caligula on trial in front of his own people, with Milosevic, with Charles Taylor of Liberia, the invader and attempted genocide in Sierra Leone, where we prevented another Rwanda from taking place. Tony Blair getting, I think, particular credit for that in West Africa. And with the humiliation, I would happily call it, of Saddam Hussein in front of the people who he tortured and murdered and ruined for so long, and others too. No, one can't wish that undone, of course. And furthermore, not a small thing, we can now certify Iraq as in compliance with UN resolutions on weapons of mass destruction, which couldn't before. That's, by the way, that's a gain. Yeah. Not knowing, not being able to certify, is a great source of insecurity and instability, by the way, as well as an outrageous breach of international law.
Do you think that some societies are not suited, or at least for the foreseeable future, to have democracy? Or is this the soft bigotry of low expectations?
Well, again, to revert to my favorite 19th century analyst and journalist and columnist, Karl Marx and his devoted sidekick, Friedrich Engels. I've published essays about both these aspects. When they weren't being brilliant about the future of British India, they were unusually shrewd about the future of the United States, which they thought to be the great country for free labor, untrammeled social mobility, innovation, and many other positively charged things. In contrast to the frightful millennial backwardness and despotism of Russia that seemed almost impervious to mm-hmm. human effort. It's the view that many great Russian writers have taken mm-hmm. of their culture. I simply don't feel entitled to pronounce on that. But one reason, I haven't been to Russia enough, I've only been there once. I've read a lot of its writers and writing, and I can understand the idea of the pessimistic Russian soul readily enough, given their history. I think the reason I'd want to resist it is because it makes something like the current Putin regime seem like the best they can do. Well, that's plainly not the case. I mean, a country in far worse straits materially than Russia could do a great deal better than the regime of personal power, in which, for some reason, there seems to be a law that says it must be true, but anyone who criticizes the regime goes missing or is mutilated or silenced in some form or another. in which there's a very, what I consider to be a very dangerous alliance between Russian nationalism and chauvinism, revived under various pretexts of humiliation that I think are very dubious, and a very dogmatic reactionary Russian Orthodox Church, which has now become the clerical garb in which, in all public ceremonies, Putinism is draped. Very reminiscent, in fact, of pre-1917 Tsarism. And for that reason, to be deplored as a terrible outcome for the Russian people and for people who live within Russia's borders, who are non-Russian, but also for Russian neighbours, because this expresses a clear nostalgia for days of Russian glory and domination and empire.
Here I asked Christopher whether or not he thought that the war in Afghanistan was worth the price. We've been fighting that war for 9 years now, or really almost a decade. And there's been a lot of talk in Washington about whether or not it's worth continuing. And he was very, as he usually is, he was very adamant in his answer.
Well, we don't have to appoint the government of Afghanistan or be responsible for its writ running. But there's never been a government of Afghanistan whose writ has run all across the country. I very much doubt there ever will be one. It certainly won't be with the Karzai regime. But it's entirely possible to make life unbearable for the Taliban if we fight more as guerrillas. For example, if they take over an area, we let them run it for a bit. You know what will happen. Apart from anything else, anyone who can leave will, and in our direction, make their lives impossible. Fight them with subversive tactics. We, among other things, have a very strong interest in continuing to train a cadre of people, as does every other NATO country, who are used to this kind of fighting in these kind of conditions, and be able to conduct it very ruthlessly. Because we're going to need it again, a lot. And I think it's important to keep engaged, and if you like, it sounds heartless, keep blooded. Because this war is not going to end until one or the other of us has given up. So to use it as a training ground for the smashing and massacre of jihad, to use it as an example of how Afghans could live, especially their women folk, but also their national minorities and religious minorities like the Hazara, Shia, and others, compared to what is offered to them by the supporters of the caliphate. So make that a permanent example. Which part of Afghanistan would you rather live in? And to interdict and destroy their remoter bases by aerial bombardment. Yes, that's something we have to keep on doing. Look, this is a NATO responsibility, backed up by a series of United Nations resolutions. If the Taliban are allowed to declare victory in Afghanistan, it means what? It means they beat the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the United States and the United Nations in open warfare and can boast about it. Well, that's an outcome that's not thinkable.
What role does economics
play? And we can certainly prevent them from doing that. I doubt even now they could take the cities on their own, let alone hold them. I think that's already probably impossible. There are large tracts of Afghanistan populated by peoples who would never submit to Taliban rule. All we have to do is make sure those people don't lose. And it means the Taliban cannot win.
My final question to Christopher were his views on Václav Havel, who I've come to admire much more than I already did, if that was possible, having now lived in the Czech Republic for a year. And he provided me with a very interesting perspective on Havel's career and also his importance in bringing democracy to Eastern Europe.
Václav Havel, perfect for my profession and yours. Ironic, understated, non-fanatical, non-violent, by folding his arms and putting a knowing smile on his face, was able to ridicule a whole edifice of totalitarianism. When the invasion of Czechoslovakia occurred in 1968, W.H. Auden was living just across the border in Austria, and he wrote a very short poem called The Ogre, which I can recite. It goes, it says, "The ogre does what ogres can. Deeds quite impossible for man. But one prize is beyond his reach. The ogre cannot master speech. About a subjugated plain, amid the suffering and the slain, the ogre stalks with hands on hips while drivel gushes from his lips." That's 20 years before, in Prague, the Civic Forum movement and its allies, by putting on plays, by writing poems, by publishing essays, by making jokes, by demonstrating the value of the written word and life lived in truth, and by nothing else, no car bombs, no bullying, no fanaticism, just brought the ogre to a halt. and let the air completely out of the bag. No one who had anything to do with it or lived through that will ever forget it. And the personal symbol of it will always be Vasubandhu.
Well, I think that's a fitting end.
So yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I think it probably is too.
You can find the transcript of the full interview with Hitchens and many other stories at our website at referl.org. We'd also love to hear what you think about this show. Just drop us a line at podcast@referl.org. Until next week, I'm Grant Padalko. Thanks for turning on The Blender.